Are you ready to turn up the heat on true crime? From blazing mysteries to scorched evidence, Crime to Burn is the podcast that dives into the world of criminal fires. Whether it's arson, cover-ups, or unsolved mysteries, we're lighting up the case files on every story.
With over 20 years of experience as a fire protection engineer, I'm here to help you understand the physics of fire and relate it to what investigators found.
Because if anybody can make true crime less terrifying, it's me.
Join us as we sift through the ashes to bring you the story behind criminal fires, including arson, bombings, and criminal negligence.
And I make sure you don't need therapy after. Tune in for a mix of expert insight, twisted tales, and a few laughs along the way. Crime to Burn, because sometimes the truth is hotter than fiction.
This is another case where I don't have a lot of information to go on about the victim. However, this time it isn't the fault of the media or my research skills. The family has just remained very private, which is entirely their right to do. But it's also one that has gotten very little media attention. But I think that there's some important elements to share about victimization and how very glad I am that the majority of criminals, particularly violent criminals, are morons, so they get caught. And for any of you that are maybe struggling with the unsolved murder or disappearance of a loved one of yours, I don't think it's that the person that murdered your loved one is one of the smart ones, more likely one of the lucky ones. And fortunately, luck tends to run out, and karma has a way of making things not right again, but at least levels the field, so just stay strong, the day is coming. What I do know about Nadine Ann Taylor is that she was an animal lover and would literally give you the shirt off her back if you needed it. She was also the loving and carefree daughter of Donna and Cecil Taylor and had a brother named Harlan and two sisters, Michelle and Dawn. Nadine was also the mother to beautiful daughters, Shatea and Shiera, and she was deeply loved by her family, and together they shared holidays and built memories over Nadine's 29 years. On June 29, 2007, a 32-year-old mild-mannered and soft-spoken man came before Justice Jamie Campbell to try to have his 2-year house arrest sentence for attempted robbery moved to a suspended sentence. Justice Campbell was surprised to find the man, who he described as having a dignified carriage and wearing a carefully chosen business suit, in front of him for having pled guilty to such serious charges a year before. Justice Campbell listened with sympathy to the man's plight. He had been working for Nova Scotia's Gaming Commission, Casino Nova Scotia, and been employed by a cruise line where he worked in the casino, but the work kept him away from home for long periods of time. So he got notice that he had to leave the ship early one time and return home to sign divorce papers that had been filed by his then wife. He came home to discover that not only had his wife divorced him, but she had also cleaned out their bank accounts. So he was left penniless with nowhere to go. He couch surfed with friends for a while before making the rather ill-advised choice of walking into the Point Pleasant grocery store one night dressed in all black with a ski mask on, which was something that Justice Campbell regarded as, "This most unusual robber started out on his tragic enterprise with an almost comic concern that he at least dressed the part of the robber." However, he was also carrying a 6-inch kitchen knife, which he showed to the store clerk, who looked at it, asked him if he wanted money, to which the man nodded yes, and then the store clerk pulled out his own knife. So the man abandoned his plans of robbery and ran out of the store. So although finding sympathy in the man's story and that this was a first-time offense and that the man had complied with all of the conditions placed on his house arrest, even though it meant that he wasn't able to go back to the cruise line and work in person, and the curfew that was on him had made him unable to work any regular shifts at like a normal casino, Justice Campbell felt that the 2-year sentence that had been given to him had been appropriate for the circumstances, considering attempted robbery normally comes with some actual jail time and not just house arrest. However, according to Campbell, the man had made a concerted effort to become reintegrated into the community. He had begun working at Tim Hortons. He was working longer than regular hours. He had been promoted to a supervisory position, had some money saved, and was paying off his debts. The judge said, quote, apparently he has not lost his work ethic. He could have taken a very different approach. He has apparently, through dedication and work, committed himself to reestablishing his life. It is in society's best interest that he be encouraged in that endeavor. And so his request was granted. 3 years after this court hearing had been held for this man, the summer of 2010, Nadine Taylor was the mother of two. She was planning her wedding to her fiancé, Jean Hape. The couple, now I don't believe that her daughters were living with her at the time, but I'm not actually sure about that. But they were sharing an apartment at the Convoy Avenue Apartments on the west side of Halifax. And for anyone that cares, Halifax is our most populated city in the Maritime Province of Nova Scotia at about 530,000 people. It is currently on my bucket list as one of the amazeball places to go see in Canada. Lots of films get made there because it mimics the landscape of many places in Europe, but Canada, of course, is pretty cheap to film here. There's also lots of history and scenery, and if you are planning a trip to Canada, I think make the Maritimes part of your planning because I don't think you'll be disappointed. I have never been, actually. I am a bit of a terrible Canadian. I don't watch hockey. I don't eat poutine. And it's actually more expensive for us to fly within Canada than it is to go to other countries because our country is so big and there's only a few domestic airlines to choose from. Anyways, things were going well for Nadine. Kind of. She was on the verge of turning her life around. She did have some addiction issues with a substance that YouTube doesn't like me saying and rhymes with schwack. And to make a living, she had been in the sex trade since dropping out of high school. Now, what led her to those choices, I have no idea, and it doesn't matter. It also doesn't really matter if she was going to get her life on track or if she was just saying that to family or friends. And before I get into the events of the summer of 2010, I have to both out myself for having been incorrect in a previous episode and tell you about an important law change that happened here in Canada. So some of you might remember in the Fox Hollow Farms murders episode, I blathered on about how we really needed to decriminalize the selling of sex services and criminalize the purchasing of sex services. Well, they actually did that like 10 years ago. I did not know that. But at the time that Herb Baumeister was being an asshat to male sex trade workers, Bill C-36 was not actually in effect. So without even having to ask my opinion, on November 6, 2014, the Criminal Act of Canada invoked Bill C-36, the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, which treats prostitution as a form of sexual exploitation that disproportionately impacts on women and girls, and its overall objectives were to protect the people who sell their own sexual services, protect communities and especially children from the harms caused by prostitution, and then reduce the demand for prostitution and its incidents. So to do this, the new laws now made it illegal to purchase or obtain sexual services for consideration or communicating in any place for that purpose, like the internet. Now, those who sell their own sexual services are protected from criminal liability for participating in the commission of this offense if the offense relates to their own sexual services. Now, since prostitution is a transaction that involves both the purchase and the sale of sexual services, the new purchasing offense makes prostitution illegal. So every time the prostitution transaction takes place, an offense is committed by the purchaser. So anyone selling their own sexual services is also protected under this new law. But one of the features, which I quite like, is that this law considered that sex trade workers in other aspects of their day-to-day lives and works, that they were to be treated with equality, in that their work in the trade cannot keep them from legally entering into contracts, for example. So when they work together to cooperatively and pool resources to pay for legitimate goods or services provided that they keep only the earnings from the sale of their own sexual services. So in these circumstances, the only person who commits an offense is the purchaser of sexual services. And this law also extends the definition of the word weapon to include a person who possesses handcuffs, rope, duct tape, or other items of restraint with intent to commit an offense, including assault or sexual assault, is guilty of an offense under Section 88. A person who uses an item of restraint to commit assault or sexual assault is guilty of the more serious form of those offenses, assault with a weapon or sexual assault with a weapon, as the case may be. So there is some very good stuff in there. And any actions, I think, to humanize sex trade workers and punish those that are using or exploiting those services is a good thing. It also provides people with the autonomy over their own bodies. So they can profit from selling their own sexual services if they so wish, and they are entitled to keep 100% of those earnings for themselves, which I think helps to turn the tables on the pimps and pushers, where the worker gets to keep the money and pays the pimp for then maybe protective services if they wish to. Although I think there's still way more pimps and traffickers out there than there really should be. So Nadine was living her life. Whether or not things were coming together for her or not, I don't know. But she was happy in her relationship with Jean. And I believe that she was sober in July of 2010, but I don't actually know. Now, I don't know what the Convoy Avenue apartments were like in 2010, but I see that by today's rental and buying market, they are not cheap. So I believe the fact that Nadine left the apartment on the night of July 28th to walk to a payphone had more to do with her keeping her communications kind of on the down low than not having a cell phone or like a landline. But that is in fact what she did. However, more than an hour goes by and she doesn't return. Now, Jean doesn't really grow concerned. He's figuring she maybe made an appointment with someone. But when she hadn't come back by very late that night, he admits that he was a little bit more angry than concerned, that she had maybe fallen off the wagon or spent the night with a client without telling him first. So Jean got on his bike and spent the night riding around the city looking for her. There had been this one guy that Jean had confronted only a few weeks before. Jean felt that this guy was developing feelings for Nadine and taking up more of her time than he really should. And Jean had told him to basically bug her off and not call her again. And so he was thinking, like, what if Nadine had also developed feelings for him? But Nadine did not return to the apartment the next day either. And now Jean was no longer angry. He was just concerned. He knew that bad things happen in the world of sex work, and as careful as Nadine tried to be, it was still considered dangerous work. And Jean knew that Nadine would not leave her kids without a word. Like, that was for sure was not like Nadine. So on July 31st, despite realizing that Nadine's disappearance was one that they probably weren't going to take all that seriously based on her career, but also that reporting her missing would expose her criminal behavior, but he was quite concerned about her. So Nadine's name was actually familiar to the police, not only because of her work and her addiction issues, but also because she had previously reported a rather vicious and violent sexual assault. And this assault had been unsolved. The man had identified himself as Jack, which was more likely a fake name, average-looking white man in his 50s with some missing teeth and blondish hair. She had escaped because she had managed to throw a rock at the window of his van, made this loud noise, which scared him off. And we have to consider how brave this was of Nadine to even report this to begin with, because by doing so, she had to admit to engaging in a criminal act during the course of an assault, something that previously, before Bill C-36, would have left her case on the bottom of a pile of other cases that police would have considered more important or worthy of solving. Like if someone steals your bike that you stole off of a porch, police aren't really all that motivated to get justice for you. And it was no different for sex workers at the time when their work was at the time criminalized. But she had reported it because she's brave and she knew that she did not deserve what had happened to her. Now, Jean had supported her in that decision and he reminded the officers of this, that maybe the guy had come back for more. He also mentioned the purchaser that was getting a little bit too close to her. She told them that she had a busy night with work that night, and then they had planned on spending the rest of the evening together, but she hadn't returned. And he had figured that maybe she had just taken off, something that happens sometimes, but something about this really felt wrong. So he described what she was wearing, including that she was wearing her favorite shoes. Police did check in with the overly friendly client. He had not seen her. He also had an alibi for the night that she had left. They checked with her mom, Donna. Donna was worried about her as well. She hadn't checked in with her for over a week, and by that point, and she always called pretty frequently. But police were not able to find any trace of Nadine. Now, when people disappear, it's usually either because they want to, which wasn't likely in Nadine's case. They take their own lives, or she could have overdosed and not been found, which is also kind of unlikely because overdoses actually usually happen at home or in fairly public places near where the person has made the purchase, or it's that they've bet with foul play, which is a real danger and possibility for anyone in the sex trade. On August 16th, police received a rather frantic call from a man calling from outside of a community police office, but it was rather late at night, so that particular district office was closed. So he had called dispatch in a panic, saying he needed help, that he had found a woman on the road badly injured. He had picked her up, tried taking her to the hospital, but she had gone all squirrely on him. So in order to subdue her, so that he could help her, he had put her in the trunk of his car. And if you're thinking to yourself, well, I mean, that makes sense. Well, you're wrong. It doesn't make sense. And the cops didn't think so either. So they ordered him to open said trunk, only it was empty. And the man seemed rather surprised to find that it was empty, only it wasn't empty entirely. There was some blood droplets indicating that somebody had been in the trunk and had obviously been injured. So this gentleman, who identified himself as Stephen Elliott Laffin, was brought into the police station that was open to answer a few questions. Now, I'm not sure if this is the exact words of Stephen Laffin from his interview with police, but it is the transcript of from CBC's The Detectives, which is season 1, episode 7, if you're interested. It was a little after 10, I was driving home. Now, this is Old Sambro Road in Halifax. You don't normally see a lot of traffic on that road, let alone somebody walking. Right away, I could tell something was wrong. Her clothes were all messed up, torn and ripped, and I saw blood. Even in the dark, that's how bad it was. I couldn't just leave her there, could I? What if whoever had done this to her was still out there? So I told her I'd take her to the cops. When I got her in the car, she said that somebody had taken her, kept her locked up. The more she talked about it, the worse she got, and then she just went crazy. She was crying and screaming. She bit me. I almost crashed the car. Then she started hitting me and hitting herself. I didn't know what to do. What the hell is wrong with you? She just went crazy. I knew that I needed to get her to the hospital, but I wasn't going to die trying. So I put her in the trunk. I didn't know what else to do. I drove straight to the nearest police outpost, and when I tried to show the officer, she must have gotten out while I was driving. Well, can you describe her? Well, her face was pretty messed up. It looked like somebody had hit her pretty badly. Who would do that to somebody? While this questioning was going on, two things happened. One was that a background check was pulled on this Stephen Laffin, who turned out to not only be the mild-mannered man that had come before Justice Campbell in 2007 for his sympathetic attempted robbery of Point Pleasant Grocery, but also had been fairly recently accused of a violent sexual assault of another sex worker, who had the misfortune to be a few minutes late for her hearing, the punishment for her tardiness being that the case was tossed out. The other thing that happened was that another call came into 911 from a farmhouse near Old Sambro Road. A woman, badly beaten and half naked, had shown up on the family's doorstep saying that she had been kidnapped and had just escaped from the man's trunk. The woman, whose identity is protected and only known as MG, had significant bruising on her chest, cuts on her neck, and some pretty nasty road rash covering about half of her body. She told police, It's still hazy. I can't remember everything. I was working. A guy picked me up at the bus stop, drove me to a parking lot, took me to a dark corner. When he got out of the car, he grabbed me and held me down. And then he just hit me over and over. He had a rock. And then he got his hands around my throat. I kept passing out and waking up. And then I was in the trunk. I saw the latch, so I opened it. The car was going so fast, but I had to get out of there. I knew if I stayed there, I'd be dead. So they told her, well, after you escaped, we have a witness who says that he picked you up from the side of the road. Do you remember that? And she said, no, I mean, some of it's a blur, but I don't think so. As soon as I got the tape off my mouth, all I could do was scream. The guy had red duct tape. I remember seeing it in the car before it all happened. When I woke up in the trunk, he had taped my mouth, my wrists, and my ankles. Police went back to Stephen and said, you know, you kind of forgot to mention that you taped her up and gagged her. Did that just kind of slip your mind? And he said, well, she was trying to claw my eyes out. What do you expect me to do? I had to tie her up. So then they show him a picture of Nadine and asked if he knew her. And he said that he had no idea who she is, that he was trying to help. Where were you on the night of the 28th? He says, I don't know. And then he says, no, wait, that was the night of my wife's bachelorette. So I was home watching TV. And I should mention here that Stephen Laffin was charged with kidnapping, aggravated assault, uttering death threats, and unlawful confinement. So he was being detained indefinitely, which is really good because police believe very strongly that Stephen was looking good for whatever had happened to Nadine, seeing that the two women's profiles kind of fit with each other. But Nadine's DNA had not been found anywhere in Stephen's car. It was only MG's. So they would need something to connect Stephen to Nadine. Stephen Laffin was born in Halifax. His father passed away when he was 16, but he'd finished high school and had a good relationship with his mom and siblings. He had married shortly after his 2007 theft charges, had a child with her. That marriage didn't work out, but there was no issues with violence or anger within the marriage. He had worked at the casino, a casino, and then on the cruise ship, and had taken up carpentry after his release from probation. He had recently married his second wife, Joanna, on July 31st. And when police pulled Stephen's phone records, they learned that he had called the man that Nadine used as her drug dealer. And the drug dealer said that Nadine had come by on the night of the 28th to buy some stuff from her. She had been driven there by some guy in a silver SUV. But the problem was Stephen didn't own a silver SUV. He drove a four-door sedan. But the dealer was adamant that this was a silver SUV, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, because it looked brand new, which kind of stood out to him, especially in that neighborhood. So then police went back and looked through some non-criminal police records and discovered that Stephen had been involved in a car accident a few days before Nadine had gone missing. His car was put out of commission, so he had been given a rental car. And when they went to the rental car office, they discovered that he had been given a silver SUV. And wouldn't you know, that car contained blood in the back that had missed the cleanup attempts that he had made. And the DNA came back to Nadine. But it wasn't a lot of blood, so they still had some hope that they might find Nadine alive. So, much to Joanna's dismay, police arrived on her doorstep with a search warrant, which she felt was completely ridiculous. There was no way her lovely and attentive husband, whom she had only just gotten back from their honeymoon with, could have hurt anybody. This all had to be some crazy mistake, according to her. So they ask her, well, if it's a mistake, then why is this luminol lighting up the basement like a Christmas tree? Well, that's not a direct quote, but it could be. Like, who knows? Like, there's evidence of blood everywhere, and it all looks like it's been wiped clean. Joanna explained that, no, you have it all wrong. While I was away at my bachelorette, a couple of guys had accosted Stephen in the driveway wanting his car, and they had bashed him over the head and he had run inside. So when I got home, I helped him clean it up because our wedding was coming up and we had people coming over the next day. And when exactly did this head bashing take place? On the 28th of July. A blood spatter expert confirmed that with the amount of blood that had been found in the basement alone, there was no way that Nadine could have survived. So when confronted with this new evidence, Stephen confessed, kind of, that it was self-defense. That she had gone crazy and come after him with a hammer. He refused to tell investigators where he had left her body. So Stephen had second-degree murder charges added to his list, and he was housed at the Dartmouth jail. While awaiting his trial, he was involved in another assault of a 57-year-old inmate, Clarence McLeod, also awaiting trial for second-degree murder. Now, Stephen was apparently the assailant in that case as well, but I don't have any other details on it. On October 4th, 2012, Stephen pled guilty to the charges against him regarding MG's assault. She had told her story to the CBC back in September of 2010, saying, quote, "He was choking me by my throat and I was trying to fight him, but I couldn't do nothing. He kept knocking me out. He kept putting me out by grabbing my throat." She said that she had been picked up by Stephen in Spryfield, and then they had driven to a parking lot where he overpowered her and assaulted her sexually. Quote, "I remember coming to and was duct taped, my mouth, my ankles, my wrists behind my back. I remember waking up because he was undoing my pants at this point. I remember sitting up and saying, shh, listen, there's somebody right there. I was trying to get him to stop, but he didn't stop. He kept going. He kept smacking my head into the ground and my chin, kept slamming my face into the ground, telling me he was going to kill me." And she then remembered being stuffed into the trunk of his car while he sped off, topping about 120 kilometers an hour. She said that she remembered her boyfriend saying once that if she ever got locked in the trunk of a car, there's always this lever to pull. So she popped the trunk, but the trunk came down so hard on her again that it knocked her out again. She doesn't know how long she was out, and then she came to, she got up, she pulled the lever again, and then just dove out head first. She says that she doesn't remember anything until coming to on the road. Him telling me he was going to kill me and whispering it in my ear, I can still feel him right there. I see him every night. I can't sleep. I don't think he expected me to get away and fight as hard as I did. I'm going to make sure he does not get out on parole somehow, some way. He does not deserve to walk these streets," end quote. Then in March 2013, he pled guilty to Nadine's murder, and as part of his plea agreement, he had to tell police where he had put Nadine's body. And so on March 2nd, police uncovered her remains from a wooded area in East Chesetcook. On April 25th, 2013, Justice Felix Caccioni handed down Stephen's sentences for both Nadine's murder and the kidnapping and assault of MG. Victim impacts were, of course, read, including one from Donna, who's Nadine's mom, who said in part, "My daughter Nadine was my precious dolly girl. She was pretty, funny, loved people and animals. She would never turn away anyone that needed help or food. There are so many precious moments and times that I will never share with my daughter Nadine. I know that every special occasion or event that I would have shared with her has been shattered as a result of her being murdered." And her aunt Bernadette said, "I can hear her crying for help in my head and I couldn't be there. That pain in my heart just won't go away," end quote. The sentencings were held on the same day, but in two different hearings. Now, Nadine's hearing was first, and when asked if he had anything to say, Stephen said, "Your Honor, I would just like to first apologize to the families involved here. I can understand their sleeplessness and the nightmares and the pain that they feel from what I have done. I, too, suffer along the same lines, although I doubt to the extent that they do. I know saying I'm sorry won't do anything and it won't bring Nadine back, but I am sorry for everything I have done and for the pain I have caused, Your Honor. That's it." In response, Justice Caccioni said, "Unfortunately, the death of Nadine has had repercussions for all, for the family, for her intended husband, who I gather took his own life. Unfortunately, that's very sad. The people that Nadine could have and would have helped had she lived." Mr. Laffin's comment to the author of the pre-sentence report in relation to having a long fuse and not losing control if angry sound hollow in light of what he did to Nadine Taylor. "Blaming his troubles on a gambling addiction is but an excuse for your behavior, Mr. Laffin. This speaks volumes about your lack of insight into your behavior." Mr. Laffin, I am not a trained psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I have been in the criminal law business for almost 40 years, and your actions in this case and in the one involving MG just a few weeks after you killed Nadine Taylor, together with your lack of remorse and insight into your behavior, leads me to conclude that you are either a psychopath or that you have psychopathic tendencies. Whatever that may be is clear that you have some issues, underlying psychological issues that must be addressed before you can ever safely be released back into society. I do hope for the safety and protection of society that you can, in the years to come, while incarcerated, gain some sort of insight into the reasons for your behavior. People just do not go around killing other people in a very violent fashion. This is not a situation of somebody having access to a gun, being all drunked up, and firing the gun. You obviously lured her, brought her to your house, and in some fashion with some weapon, be it a hatchet or hammer, killed Nadine Taylor. Think about it. The sentence of this court is that you be imprisoned for life. Further, that you not be eligible to apply for parole for a period of 13 years. Now, during MG's hearing, Stephen said of his own actions, Your Honor, this morning, earlier today, you had made statements about me not knowing myself very well. And I believe you are correct, Your Honor. I don't know myself very well anymore, as well as I thought I did, obviously, which is why I have been meeting with a counselor at the facility, the chaplain there, meet with him on a one-to-one basis, just to help me sort through and discover who I am and help me with problems that I had been facing up until my leading to my arrest. I am sorry for the damage that I have done. I think the value of a man, Your Honor, was measured in his wealth and his money and his possessions. And since coming to the jail, since my arrest, I have since discovered that this isn't true. The value of a man is measured in the effect that he has on the people he has around them. I believe, Your Honor, and the effects that I have on people show people have not been good. This is how I know how little I have become worth and how low I have fallen from who I used to be as a child growing up. I am sorry for Miss G and to her family and to Nadine's family as well for everything that I have done. Your Honor, there is nothing I can do to change those, but I believe that with time I can change who I become back to who I should be. And Your Honor, I am not beyond redemption. So I ask the court not to give up on me either. Thank you, Your Honor. And the judge said in this case, the factual background is that on August 16th, Mr. Laffin picked up Miss G looking to engage in sexual activity with her. Miss G was struggling with an addiction. Her addiction led her to work the streets, and that is what she was doing that night because the addiction was so strong and her cravings for drugs was so strong. Mr. Laffin picked her up. At some point, he attempted to choke her by putting her arm around her throat. There was a struggle. Miss G screamed. Mr. Laffin put his hand on her mouth. He tried to choke her with his hands. Miss G passed out. When she woke up, her hands were tied behind her back. I believe it was duct tape. Mr. Laffin then taped her mouth and head. He smashed her head into a rock on the ground, told her that she was the second one that he had done this to, and if she did not have any money, he would kill her. What is unnerving about this factual situation was that Miss G's testimony that while doing this and saying these things to her, Mr. Laffin did not appear angry. He did not appear upset. He appeared to Miss G that her crying had some sort of an arousal factor for Mr. Laffin. Her shoes were removed. Her pants were partially removed. He put tape over her nose. The next thing that Miss G recalls was being in the trunk of a car. Had it not been for her wherewithal in remembering the safety latch on the inside of a vehicle, safety trunk latch, one is left to speculate as to what would have occurred to her. Given what Mr. Laffin had done previously to some weeks previously, it is scary to think of what could have happened, but that did not happen. Miss G managed to escape. She was rescued, if one could call it that word, by some people who heard her banging on their door, took her in. Police were called in the actions of Mr. Laffin in then going to the police and presenting them with this story of finding a bloody half-naked woman on the road and putting her in his car really leads me to question what Mr. Laffin is all about. I said it this morning. I think it is quite scary. Miss G's injuries took some weeks to heal. She had some recurring nightmares about the incident. She is fearful, constantly looking over her shoulders, and has a fear that Mr. Laffin will return to finish what she believes he started on that evening. This is a very difficult sentencing. Mr. Laffin has shown by his behavior an inability to control himself with respect to marginalized women. He has also been sentenced to life imprisonment. With respect to the offense of kidnapping MG with the intent to cause her to be confined against her will, the sentence of this court is that you be imprisoned for a period of 4 years. With respect to the sentence that you did commit an assault on MG, that you endangered her life and you committed an aggravated assault on her, the sentence of this court is that you be sentenced to a period of 9 years incarceration, concurrent to any other sentence you are presently serving, which is the life sentence. With respect to uttering threats, there will be a sentence of 2 years, also concurrent, and with respect to the unlawful confinement, another 2 years concurrent. All sentences are concurrent to each other and concurrent to your life sentence. The total sentence, therefore, is of 9 years in a federal institution on an on-go-forward basis. Mr. Laffin, I do hope that you are not trying to deceive yourself into believing that your actions are just an aberration, that you really have to work hard to examine who you are, why you did what you did, and certainly will have long enough to think about that. MG has since left the sex trade. She is working on her recovery. Stephen Laffin became eligible for parole in October of 2023, but I have not seen any updated reporting, so hopefully he didn't bother to apply or has been denied and is still behind bars. And thankfully, in today's world, women and men in the sex trade business can report assaults without any fear of any repercussions. And that was the horrible, wretched case of Nadine Taylor and of MG as well. And I am going to be back again next week with another case, as always. You guys know what to do. Subscribe, follow, like, review, share it. Make a recommendation to a friend about if you like the podcast or if you like the YouTube channel. I have merch available on spreadshop.com. There's exclusive and ad-free episodes available on either Red Circle, which you can add a link if you're listening on Apple, or also on Patreon, which you can add that to your Spotify account. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Welcome to Primetime Crime Podcast. I am your host, Kylie, and in this podcast, we are going to deep dive into some lesser known unsolved true crime cases, from missing persons to unsolved homicides. This is the place where we are going to unpack it all, research it all, talk about it all, and try to bring justice to these families after all of these years. We are going to take it one story at a time, one case at a time, and hopefully justice will be ours. I hope you all will join me on this journey. You can find me at Primetime Crime, wherever you get your podcasts.